This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. You've probably heard Mike Judge's voice, though you may not recognize it in today's interview. Mike Judge has done the voices of the title characters for his animated MTV series Beavis and Butthead. He also co-created the Fox animated series King of the Hill and does the voice of the main character Hank Hill, as well as Hank's friend Boomhauer. Mike Judge also made the film comedies Office Space and Idiocracy. And he wrote and directed the film comedy Extract, which is now out on DVD. Extract stars Jason Bateman as the beleaguered owner of a small factory making vanilla extract and other flavors. When a beautiful young woman, played by Mila Kunis, asks for a job at his factory, he wants to figure out how he can have an affair with her without feeling guilty about his wife. What he doesn't know is that this innocent-looking woman is a con artist. Here she is in the opening scene in a music store shopping for a guitar. She's asked the two young male sales clerks about a guitar that's caught her attention. Meanwhile, her good looks have caught their attention.
Yeah, it's expensive, but it's sweet.
Yeah, are you familiar with Gibson humbucking pickups at all, or?
No, I'm sorry. I actually don't play. It's for my dad for his 50th birthday.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah, my sisters and I are all chipping in, so.
Your dad will love these humbuckings. I mean, they really kick ass.
Excuse me, I just have a quick question about
what kind of music does your dad play?
I guess it's kind of jazz-ish, maybe.
Oh, this is an excellent jazz guitar. Pat Metheny plays one of these.
Probably the best one.
Yeah.
Is your dad into Metheny at all?
Oh, I'm sorry. I actually have no idea who that is.
Pat Metheny is probably the best fusion player of our times. He's like the Jakey Lee of fusion guitar players.
Yeah. Are you into fusion?
I don't really know what that is either.
It's just, I was asking because I play fusion guitar. Just kids.
Yeah, I play fusion too, actually.
Teach kids. I
work really?
With, yeah, I work with a lot of kids.
Mm-hmm. You should come check our band out.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yeah, so what do you think?
Well, do you guys maybe have it in other colors?
Color? You mean finishes.
Finishes?
Yeah, we have a sunburst. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I just stocked one of those in the back.
Yeah,
I'll grab
back.
It.
No, I can pick it up.
You want to see it?
I get it.
Okay.
No,
I'll get it.
Comes
thank
with
you.
A case.
We'll I'm going to get the case.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to grab the case.
Awesome.
While the sales clerks are in the back, she walks out of the store with the guitar. Terry spoke to Mike Judge in August when King of the Hill was airing its final episodes and Extract was in theaters.
Mike Judge, welcome to Fresh Air. Office Space, your movie from a few years ago, is from the point of view of workers who think their bosses are incompetent. Extract is from the point of view of the head of a company who founded the company. It must have been a shift in frame of mind for you to go from the employer point of view to the head of the company point of view?
Yeah, I had worked just dozens and dozens of jobs before I started my animation career. And by that point, I was pushing 30. So I had always been the employee. I had never had anybody work for me. It was always me working for somebody else. And then suddenly, when Beavis and Butthead started, I had anywhere from 30 to as many as 90 people working for me. And so I just suddenly became sympathetic to my former bosses. You know, I was just like, God, these people don't appreciate anything. I got to babysit them. They're always fighting with each other and me. And I'd wanted to do something that was kind of the counterpoint to Office Space.
So describe some of the characters in the Extract Factory in your new movie, Extract, that have a similarity to people you worked with on Beavis and Butthead.
For example, when Beavis and Butthead happened, you know, you try to be a nice boss, and then that doesn't really work very well most of the time, you know, because you get taken advantage of. There was a guy we did this album, Beavis and Butthead. It was just called the Beavis and Butthead Experience. It was a CD with Geffen Records, and I'd done the line art for the cover. And back then, the way you would do it is you'd actually paint a cell. Cell painting is something you'd pay somebody, I don't know, at the time, $10 an hour to do. But there was some money in this budget for this album cover. So I said, well, I'm going to throw someone a bone here. You know, the show's a hit. And I got one of the painters and I said, hey, can you paint this? Now, mind you, I had done all the line art. All he's doing is basically coloring it, filling in the spaces with color. So I got him $800 to do one cell, and I go by and I hear him. I won't use the explicit language, I guess, but I go by and he's going, "Man, this is BS, man. These guys are going to make millions of dollars and they're paying me $800, man. This is," and I was like, "God, I can't win."
No, one of the characters who works in the factory in your movie Extract is in a band, a grindcore band.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's just obsessed with, like, passing out leaflets to get people to go to his performances and stuff. And yeah. Describe him and who he's based on.
Partly it's based on the guy I was talking about on Beavis and Butthead, but that guy wasn't in a band. But actually, when I worked in the factory that made guitar amps, there was a guy that sat near me that I just had overheard him saying once, you know, he said, actually, I'm in three bands right now. And, you know, there's a certain type of nerd that has, you know, that keeps tattooing themselves and piercing themselves and kind of goth, you know. And I knew the kind of music I wanted him to play, but I didn't know what it was called. And so I had to, people have really, you know, I mean, heavy metal has turned into this, I don't even know, it's esoteric, like just there's so many
subcategories. There's thousands of subgenres, I know.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you can read about people arguing about what's death grind versus grindcore. And so I wanted him to be one of those guys, you know, and I had a pool cleaner at one point, not to do with the gigolo pool cleaner in the movie, this is completely separate. This guy was a really nice guy, you know, kind of had tattoos and stuff, but just, you know, always talking about the chlorine levels and all this stuff, and then gave me his CD once of his band, and it was just like this screaming music with titles like Death to Soccer Mom and all this stuff. And it was just like, it just struck me as funny. It's just kind of like, you know, he goes to work, he drives his forklift, he does all this stuff, but he's really all about this crazy, it's almost like Dungeons and Dragons type world of, you know,
anger
or death. Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. You actually cast in your movie Extract my good friend Gene Simmons. And I say that because a lot of listeners of the show know that we had a kind of rough interview together.
Yeah, I actually looked that up because I had heard about that.
You'd heard about that? So you cast him as this kind of sleazy lawyer who has, you know, all this like slip and fall, soon now, tacky TV ads and billboards.
Well, I'll tell you, I'd written in the script that the lawyer looks like, I said he looks like Gene Simmons with a suit and tie and a ponytail. And then when we started casting it, we were looking at a bunch of people, and some really good actors wanted to do that, actually. And there were some, you know, really good actors read for it. Nothing was popping in the right way. And actually, my producer, John Altshuler, goes, you know, because I was trying to articulate what it is I'm looking for, and he goes, he just needs to be a running sore of a human being. And then shortly after that, we had Gene Simmons come in. You know, he's a piece of work. He's a very intelligent guy. You know, I was a little worried maybe he'd be on musician time or, you know, we're dealing with a rock star. That can be a pain in the butt. But, I mean, he came in and he was just a total pro. Like, I would start to give him direction and I'd say, "Hey, do you want to do such and such?" And he'd just say, "I will do whatever you want. You just tell me." And, you know, he's got that voice, too, that just, there's one line he says where he says, "I'm sorry, did you just threaten me?" And someone at the lab was saying that every time he'd watch one of those takes, he'd get goosebumps. So, you know, I think it was a good choice. You know, he's a piece of work, and when he's on the set, he's on the set, you know.
One other character in the movie I have to ask you about, the character is played by David Koechner. He's Jason Bateman's next-door neighbor, and he's the neighbor who's always inviting you over to dinner or to the movies, and, like, you don't really want to go, and you want to be nice, you want to decline politely, but he doesn't get it when you're polite. He thinks, "Oh, well, tomorrow night you won't be as busy."
Yeah.
I thought it just really captured a certain dynamic awfully well.
Yeah, it was back a while back. We rented and then bought a place in this gated community out in L.A. for the summer by the beach, and you know, pretty expensive place. And you pay all this money, and then there was this one woman who was just single-handedly bringing down the property value for me, like by like huge amounts. I mean, basically, she would just park herself in your window and start talking to you and give you a choice of either being really rude or listening to her for as long as, you know, an hour and a half. I mean, and yeah, and just constantly like just getting herself into your life somehow. And I mean, there's somebody who I actually kind of like and who does the same thing, but he'll like, yeah, actually more than one. There's a lot of people who do this, but who are just a master of making you think the conversation is winding down so that you kind of start to get nice again, and then they just suck you back in, you know. And
would you describe Hank Hill and his family?
Hank he sells propane and propane accessories, and he's got his house and his family, and he's kind of has this way that he thinks the world ought to be that's maybe he belongs in the 50s or something like that. And, you know, he's just up against all the ridiculous things that the modern world brings. And
He lives in a suburb. He's the kind of guy who goes to Home Depot and drinks beer with his friends. He's probably politically conservative. At the same time, he's very open-minded and often does things that would go against whatever ideology he would seem to profess. And he wants to always do the right thing by individuals, whether or not that coincides with what his like larger ideological belief might be. Now, you do the voice of Hank.
Yes.
I want to play a scene from a recent episode. And you do two regular voices in the series, Hank and his friend Boomhauer. And Boomhauer has this kind of like postmodern mumble
that's <Yeah. laughs>
really hard to make like sense that. Of what he's saying. So Boomhauer has just swapped homes with a Canadian couple, so he's about to leave Canada for 3 months.
Oh, yeah.
So here's Hank and Boomhauer, and I think a couple of friends are with them there, too.
This will no doubt be the best summer of our entire lives.
Yep.
Well, I tell you what, man, I'd love to just chill back and then get a dang old grill and chill, man, but I've got to head up Canada this summer, man.
Canada? A man only has so many summers, Boomhauer. Why would you waste yours in a country that's dismantling its navy?
Talking about them house swap with no Canadian family for them, eh?
House swap? There's going to be Canadians living here, walking around, touching things for 3 whole months?
You're going to be gone for an absurd amount of time. What if we all make new friends or get remarried? It could happen. Love is funny.
That's a scene from a recent episode of King of the Hill with my guest, the creator of the series, Mike Judge, as Hank Hill and as his friend Boomhauer. And what I was saying about, you know, Hank Hill always doing the right thing, even though he's like so uptight about the idea of Canadians. At the same time, when the house swap is over, he and his wife Peggy invite the Canadians to live in their home. They're always going to do the right thing. So, you know, as I'm talking to you, I'm listening for the sounds of Hank Hill in your voice, and I hear it. But also, what you're doing for Hank Hill, though, is different. There's much more of a southern twang to it. Can you talk about creating the voice for Hank?
Well, you know, I had a paper out when I was a kid in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and on my paper out, there was a guy. It was the first time my brother and I shared this paper out, and we'd go collect it at the end of every month, and this guy was always out on his front lawn drinking a beer, and we came to collect, and this is our first time collecting, and this guy looks at us and is kind of staring at us. We said, "Hi, we're collecting for the Albuquerque News." And he says, "Well, you ain't my paper boy," and said, "Well, I know, but your paper boy quit, and we're the new paper boy." And he said, "Well, I know what my paper boy looks like, and you ain't my paper boy." And he said, "Well, yeah, he's gone, and you know," and then he brings his wife over and says, "Is he the paper boy?" No, this went on. We said, "Well, we're going to have to cancel the paper then." He said, "Oh, I'm going to get the paper when the real paper boy comes." And So we just kept delivering, and we'd skip his house, and he'd be out there drinking his beer, kind of eyeballing us. And finally, he swallowed his pride after like 4 months, and he called in a subscription. And I mean, the first time my ex-wife and I, we bought a house in outside of Dallas, and there'd be these guys out there drinking their beers in the alley, and you know, like, the storm had like blown off, just knocked loose a little part of my fence. So I went out there and I was, you know, I got a hammer and I'm just thinking, okay, I'll just nail this thing back there. And I see this guy over kind of eyeballing me, looking at what I'm doing. And then he comes over, followed by a couple others, and he says, "Well, you're going to have to take the whole section out. And this post here is a little rotted." And then before I know it, one of them brings over a wheelbarrow. They yanked out the whole thing. They're digging up a fence post. They're pouring concrete. They're mixing concrete. And finally, I kind of became kind of useless. I went back inside, and my wife at the time, like, you know, we hadn't even eaten breakfast, and we're looking out the window, and she goes, "What's going on?" And I said, "Oh, they're building me a fence, I guess." And then I went back out there. Finally, they got the post set, and they did the string across, whatever, and he's saying, you know, "You got to leave a 1-inch gap, otherwise them termites are going to get on your palings." And so he tells me how to do it. I start putting on the palings. This is much, you know, like 3 or 4 hours later. I'm hammering the nails in. I see him over, and he peeks his head out of the alley. He's looking at me, and he walks over, and I'm going, "Oh, God, what now?" And he comes over and says, "Those are the wrong kind of nails. You're going to need galvanized steel. Here, I'll go get you some." Anyway, I just thought this would be like a funny kind of world, because they really were good neighbors. I mean, they were nice people, and they were helpful. And it's kind of like what you're saying about, I don't even know what their politics were. I don't even care. I don't know what, I think people who analyze shows like this probably tend to put too much of politics on it, because I don't think people like this, including myself, don't wake up and think about politics all day. You've got work to do and this kind of stuff. And so, I think it's just kind of like about neighbors who, you know, and like you say, ultimately do the right thing and do right by people and are basically good people.
So let's talk about the character of Boomhauer that has that postmodern mumble. Can you do that for us, break it down for us?
Well, I'd actually had the idea for this character in the second Beavis and Butthead short I did, where they go to a monster truck show. I'd actually recorded it and did a drawing of a guy, but I ended up cutting it because I was just, that was when I was animating everything myself, and it was going to take too long. I had to cut stuff. But there was a guy I knew in Dallas that was actually from Louisiana, and when he would get really, when he'd have a few drinks, he would just start slipping into this deep accent, and you couldn't understand what he was saying, but you kind of knew what he was talking about. Another time I was getting directions from somebody in Oklahoma City over the phone, and the guy just said, "Hey, man, come up on I-35 and you go to exit 5-9, then turn over there by the gas station, and you're just right there, man." This long bunch of stuff I didn't understand ended with, "Then you're right there, man." But I think what I really kind of, on Beavis and Butthead, there was a guy who left a voicemail complaining about the show, and I don't know how he got this, but he thought the name of the show was Porky's Butthole, and I don't. And he left this voicemail that I still have. I have a tape of it where he said, "I've been calling y'all for about a month now. Grab about y'all every time them dang old loon tune come on. You put on dang pogies, freaking old butthole. Y'all with them jobbing them dang old commercials on time and time again, man." And it was just, I kind of could understand. He was kind of complaining that the show is on too often and that it doesn't start right on the hour, but I don't know where. Anyway, so yeah, I actually kind of listened to that tape a lot to sort of, when I was first trying to get the voice down.
So for anybody who missed Beavis and Butthead when it was on, describe the two characters.
Well, they're also kind of hard to describe, but they're just, you know, basically kind of inane, dumb 15-year-olds, and they would It started out as it was going to be them just sitting on a couch watching music videos, not talking to camera but talking to each other. And then we started doing these little mini episodes, well, from the get-go. They became the scapegoat of bad television or something for a while there.
Well, let's hear a scene, and we'll get to hear what their kind of mumbly voices are like and their famous laughs. So here's a scene. It's Halloween. It's Halloween night, and they're watching TV.
Isn't this the same place that those other kids got killed 2 years ago?
Don't be crazy, Tina. You act like you don't even want to get it on.
That dude with the mask is messed up.
Yeah, really. He didn't even wait for that chick to take off her shirt.
Yeah. It's like, this could never happen in real life. Damn it, that's like the 10th time tonight or something.
Maybe we should see who it is.
Oh, yeah.
Trick or treat.
Cool.
Who was that?
Just some dudes passing out free samples.
Cool. Free samples rule. Yeah.
You take my kids' candy, and I kick your ass! Happy Halloween!
Wayne.
That's a scene from Beavis and Butthead with my guest Mike Judge, the creator of the series, doing the voices of Beavis and Butthead. I love that. I mean, these characters, characters sit around watching TV, condescending to watch what they're watching all day, and they're so stupid that they don't even know that it's Halloween and this is a trick or treat bag. They think it's free samples, yeah. But it's like you've really captured in this condescension as a way of life, as just like a sport, just sitting around making fun of other people, not realizing quite how stupid you are yourself.
Yeah, well, I've known guys like this that just, you know, I remember this guy in college, just like fat schlub of a guy, and I was talking about, just like sitting on the couch, and I said, I was talking about somebody that my roommate knew, and I said, yeah, he just made the basketball team, you know, UC San Diego, and yeah, I was impressed. He just made the basketball team. This guy just sits there and he goes, basketball. You know, I'm thinking like, who the hell are you to say basketball? And so, it was always fun to have these guys who are just obviously complete losers and no one hangs out with them but each other. And yet, you know, in Butthead's mind, he thinks he's super cool and he can put down whatever he sees on TV, and I don't know. It's kind of that was fun to me. It's weird to hear it on the radio, though.
Well, tell us about the voices that you came up with for Beavis and Butthead.
Well, this was the first time when I was making animated shorts. This was the first time that I had started with a drawing that I didn't have a voice for. Usually, I had different voices that I did, kind of characters, and then I would try to come up with a drawing. This one, I had these drawings. I didn't know what they would sound like, but there was a guy I went to high school with who was not like Beavis and Butthead at all. He was actually a straight A student, and he always sat in the front of class, and he would kind of laugh at everything the teacher said, just kind of a suck up move, you know. And he was always kind of like biting on his lower lip and just kind of sitting there like writing, taking notes really fast, and just kind of going. So I figured that would be Beavis's laugh, and then Butthead, I had written "ha ha ha" on the storyboard for the first short I did, and I actually remember finding this tape of myself trying out different laughs after the show was a hit. I was going through tapes looking for something, and I was listening to this, going, "Man, if I had done the laugh that other way or that other way, you know, maybe the show wouldn't have worked." And it's kind of freaked me out a little bit.
You know, I think a lot of people criticize Beavis and Butthead in its time for bringing down the intelligence level of television and from being stupid.
Oh, yeah.
But it was about stupid people.
Exactly.
Did you feel like it was misunderstood that what you were trying to ridicule, you were ridiculed for, you were criticized for?
I mean, I think it was really hugely misunderstood. The problem was, though, that we cranked out so many so quickly that sometimes there's, you know, a few episodes that I think deserve to be criticized as being kind of dumb because they just weren't. To me, when it was good, though, it's a show about stupid people. It's not a stupid show, and that's a big difference, I think. And I think a lot of people didn't get that at all, especially early on. But I don't know. It's my favorite thing I've ever done. I think I'm really proud of it.
I recently saw the adult version of Beavis or Butthead at the airport. He was reuniting with a friend, and I swear he had his laugh. He was probably like 35 or something, but he just sounded like he was one of the characters from the series, and it was just so odd. In a way, I think your movie from 2006, Idiocracy, is about like what if Beavis and Butthead grew up. And if everybody was like that smart and people of Beavis and Butthead's intelligence levels were like ruling the world.
I definitely felt like that there was a connection between that and Beavis and Butthead. So, yeah, it's definitely a connection there.
Yeah, let me explain the premise of Idiocracy. The premise is that evolution has kind of headed in a backwards direction. Instead of people becoming smarter, they're becoming stupider. And the reason why is that all the kind of like smart, professional, educated people are either not having babies or they're having babies late and they're having very few babies. And all the stupid people don't even know whether they're using birth control or not. And they're just like having babies right and left and not educating them particularly well. And then so like the world is taken over by people who are not smart. And as part of the setup, there's somebody played by Luke Wilson who participates in this secret military experiment to be put into hibernation for a year. But the experiment goes terribly wrong and he is in hibernation for 500 years. And when he emerges from hibernation, everybody is just like incredibly dumb. So let me play a scene here after he gets out of hibernation and he's in this new world where everybody's incredibly dumb, including all the leaders of the country.
Okay, wait a minute. I'm the smartest guy in the world? Says who?
The IQ test you took in prison. You got the highest score in history. Brought to you by Carl's Jr.
Yeah, dumbass. You've been smarter than President Camacho. That's how come he's making you Secretary of Interior.
Okay, so who are you?
I'm the Secretary of Energy.
You won a contest, got to be a cabinet member. I'm the Secretary of State, brought to you by Carl's Jr.
Why do you keep saying that?
Because they pay me every time I do. It's a really good way to make money. You're so smart, why don't you know that? The Secretary of Defense.
Huh?
And Funbags over there is the Attorney General.
Hi. And that's Secretary of Education.
It's kind of stupid, but he's President Camacho's stepbrother. Still does a pretty good job, eh?
You know, I think there's been some kind of mistake, because the test I took was real, real easy. I'm not the smartest guy in the world. Okay?
That's a scene from my guest Mike Judge's film Idiocracy, which is on DVD. It came out in 2006, starring Luke Wilson. I'm sure that this movie must be based on your thoughts that people around you seem to be getting less intelligent. So can you give us some examples of like the frustrations you were experiencing at the time you wrote this that led to this fear that we're evolving backwards when it comes to intelligence?
Sure. Yeah. I'd had the idea while I was writing the Beavis and Butthead movie. I guess I was just thinking about evolution, and now that there's no predators and everybody survives, where would it go? But so I'd written down something about this idea, and then it was in 2001. I was at Disneyland, and I was waiting in line at the Alice in Wonderland ride with my daughter and somebody, or both daughters, I guess, and somebody behind me had a stroller. and two little kids, and her and this other woman with two little kids was passing by. I guess they'd had an altercation, and they just start getting in this cussing match with each other, just, you know, bitch this, and but, you know, just yelling and like, I'll kick your ass and all. And I was just sitting there thinking, wow, the Disneyland of that was envisioned way back in the 50s and to right now. And then I started thinking of, you know, it's the year 2001. What if, you know, I loved the movie 2001, but I thought, what if instead of that movie, it was just like a movie about the Jerry Springer show and the giant Walmarts, and what if they had really actually gotten it right? And so I thought I would take, you know, from those 50s sci-fi movies to now and just kind of go out another 500 years on that progression.
So Luke Wilson, who comes out of hibernation is, and is intelligent and is surrounded by all these really kind of like dumb people, they all call his style of speaking faggoty.
Yeah.
Because he actually knows a lot of words and you can understand what he's saying. I thought that was really funny.
Yeah, I remember when I was in junior high, which was just downright scary. I mean, I was actually like afraid I was going to get stabbed every day. I remember just answering a question in class, I don't know, like in math class or something, and saying, you know, oh, I know the answer, raise my hand, I know the answer, and it's blah, 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 and, you know, being articulate and saying it, you know, and just hearing someone behind me go, fag. you know, like, I was also thinking, okay, all those people in junior high who wanted to beat me up because I got answers right on quizzes and stuff, what if they were just all running the world, you know? What if that's all you had? And, you know, that's why I had stuff like just seeing airplanes crashing in the background and, just, you know, just seeing everything go to hell. And so, yeah, it was I guess it's kind of a dark vision, but it's, I don't know, I thought it was pretty funny. I also thought Luke was great. That's part of the reason I made the movie was Luke Wilson wanted to do it, and I did a rewrite with imagining him doing it, and it was just kind of, it kind of started to come alive a little more. I love seeing him in disbelief, you know. I like seeing him react to stuff. He has a real funny way of doing that. And also just seemed like the perfect guy to play somebody who's in the current world, present world, just very average, but,
right,
you know, see him be the smartest guy around and not believe that he's the smartest guy around and not know what to do with that. And
I should mention this film too, like everybody is supersized. Like they're not only not bright, but they're really big. Because that's what everybody eats. It's just it's a total fast food world. It's really been fun to talk with you. Thank you so much, Mike Judge.
Likewise. Thank you.
Mike Judge speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in August. Mike Judge's movie Extract is now out on DVD. After a long absence, Mel Gibson returns to the screen as an actor in the new film Edge of Darkness. It's a conspiracy thriller in which a Boston police detective sets out to solve his daughter's murder. The film is co-written by William Monahan, who wrote The Departed, and directed by Martin Campbell, who cast Daniel Craig as James Bond in Casino Royale. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Here is Mel Gibson as a Boston police detective shambling onto the screen in Edge of Darkness for the first time in nearly a decade. And it's hard for us, and probably harder for him, to shake off that decade's effects. He became one of the richest men in Hollywood, but also a pariah. He proved as director of The Passion of the Christ and Apocalypto to be an amazing, at times visionary filmmaker, but with an inner life that seemed so primitive and paranoid that his vision bordered on barbaric. The years now show in his face, which isn't so much wrinkled as creviced. His breeziness is gone. He's stripped down to pure, righteous anger. His rage is never far from the surface. Gibson's Thomas Craven loses his only daughter early in Edge of Darkness, and that's not a spoiler. It fuels everything that follows. The loss is grisly and shocking and launches the detective on a winding trail that leads to a nuclear power facility that might or might not have a weapons program and might or might not be connected to shadowy government elements. Danny Houston plays its head. He's tall and unctuous and crisply tailored and carries ghoulish traces of the vampire lord he played in 30 Days of Night. He has a laughably sleek office atop the well-guarded power plant with huge windows overlooking the Connecticut River. As everyone keeps telling Craven, he's in over his head. Black sedans with tinted windows follow him as he beats up people his daughter encountered in the last year of her life. He always starts polite, but in the face of evasions, he's apt to get mean. He tells the people he's beating up he has nothing left to lose. The movie has a wild card. Ray Winstone as some kind of independent contractor and maybe assassin who, for some reason, reaches out to Craven instead of rubbing him out. They sit on the bank of Boston Harbor and get personal.
If I was an employee at Northmore and I wanted to blow the whistle on something, what would I be blowing the whistle on? Let us take a walk and we can talk about it. I'm not walking in the dark with you. You're a wise man. You're on my side. But it's hard to tell. What's that like? Not being anyone in particular. I don't know what it means to have lost a child. But I know what it means never to have had one. Yeah. Got nobody left to bury you.
You might have been surprised at Gibson's South Boston accent, which takes some getting used to, but is less annoying than most of the casts in Mystic River. He's very good. But then, he's always been good. And his role in Edge of Darkness isn't so much a departure as a grim distillation of what he did before. In a score of movies, too many to list, the formula comes down to MMM, make Mel mad. Make him say, "You killed my child. You killed my wife. You killed my child and my wife. You killed my dog." Craven's daughter's mother is never mentioned. It's like a virgin birth by the dad. Craven has visions of his daughter after she dies, both as a little girl and all grown up. They might be delusional, but I think in the end, they're meant to be real. She has crossed over, as they say, but isn't gone. For all the mysticism and anti-military industrial complex speechifying, Edge of Darkness is still your basic meathead revenge picture. On its own debased terms, though, it works like gangbusters. Director Martin Campbell, coming off Casino Royale, has a style that's blunt and bruising. The shootings are what violence mavens call wet, that is, splattery. And every time you see a door or a window, you're primed for a shotgun blaster explosion, an unbelievably loud one, so you're always on edge. The audience I saw it with went nuts with joy whenever Gibson taunted a bad guy, and hyper nuts when he blew one away. Gibson is a professed Christian with an Old Testament fury, or maybe the fury of Revelations. Anything for an excuse to not turn the other cheek.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. The 2008 presidential election was the longest and most expensive in U.S. history. The campaign's the subject of a new book, Game Change, by two political reporters, John Heilman from New York Magazine and Time Magazine's Mark Halperin. The book's revelations have made headlines, but our critic-at-large John Powers says the authors mostly add to the body of political writing that feeds public cynicism about American elections.
Back when Theodore White did his groundbreaking book, The Making of the President, 1960, it was easy to write about elections. Most Americans didn't know very much about how campaigns actually worked. These days, we're all experts on push polling, NASCAR dads, and those oddball Iowa caucuses. For an election book to register now, it must offer something new, something hot. It has to dish. If any account of the 2008 campaign does just that, it's Game Change by John Heilman and Mark Halperin, a laughably written yet highly readable book that The Economist has described as high-quality political porn. Because most of its pages rehearse yet again the campaign's greatest hits, you know, Bill Clinton's gaffes, Obama's trouble with Reverend Wright, Palin's disastrous interview with Katie Couric, its real selling point is its juicy stuff. That Harry Reid talked about Obama's lack of Negro dialect, that McCain's aides thought Palin unfit to be Veep, and that Elizabeth Edwards behaved hideously to her husband's campaign staff. Such TMZ-ish revelations have won the book lots of headlines. But Game Change also raises questions about a certain kind of political reporting. The first is about sourcing. To get their scoops, the authors have relied on so-called deep background interviews with anonymous sources. They've taken a lot of heat for this approach, which seemingly allows disgruntled losers to say just about anything under a cloak of secrecy. Now, this doesn't mean that what Heilman and Halperin describe didn't happen. They're solid reporters, and when they say something took place, I believe them. Indeed, both Reed and Edwards essentially acknowledge that they did what the book says they did. The trouble with blind sources has less to do with facts than with what those facts mean. Early on, we're told that Hillary Clinton freaked out so much on losing Iowa that one of her most senior aides thought, "This woman shouldn't be president." A judgment so damning, the authors naturally put it in italics. I don't doubt that this happened, yet a lot depends on whose judgment we're getting. Was this unnamed aide someone Clinton turned on? Did he or she quit the campaign because Hillary was unfit? Or was this simply the kind of angry thought we all have in the heat of the moment and then vanishes the next day? If we don't know the story's source, we can't assess whether it's a serious judgment of Hillary or just a cheap shot. To say this is to confront another problem, the inability to see what really matters in a campaign. Favoring gossip over analysis, Heilman and Halperin can't be bothered to discuss substantive things like Clinton's vote for the Iraq War resolution. It only matters to them as an electoral liability. Or the way that Obama's early big money backers were rich Wall Street bundlers. A fact that just might have some bearing on how he's handled the financial crisis. Instead, Game Change traffics in anecdotes that usually make Obama look good, he won after all, and make the losers look petty, sleazy, or worse. We see McCain flipping off his wife Cindy while showering her with F-bombs. As for Elizabeth Edwards, the authors happily debunk her saintly image, telling us that her husband's team saw her as, quote, an abusive, intrusive, paranoid, condescending, crazy woman. Now, I realize that journalism is not a gentlemanly business, but I'm not sure there's any reason, other than a desire for sales, to tell us about a defeated candidate's marital spats, or to take such ungallant glee in trashing a woman with life-threatening cancer and an adulterous husband whose political career is now kaput. Such an approach only feeds public cynicism, the belief that those running for office are all creeps and phonies. I don't want to sound like a sucker, but the truth is more complicated and more interesting. Politics is about character, of course, often bad character. But it's also about values, ideas, and yes, even policies. What makes presidential candidates so endlessly fascinating is that their whole life becomes a negotiation between their almost pathological ambition and their idealistic dreams of how they'd like to remake the world. It's a negotiation that includes us, the American people, who have ambitions and desires of our own. Never was this a grander story than in 2008, the greatest presidential campaign of our lives. And it's depressing to see men as smart as Heilman and Halperin fritter it all away. Finishing their book, I realized that they hadn't told me a single important thing I didn't already know. On the contrary, they've taken an election that proved how big this country really is and made it seem as small as a reality show.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and writes the Absolute Powers blog for Vogue.com.